everybody has their own view of King. If you come from a religious background, you will empathize with King as a religious thinker, a religious leader. I suppose I view King, or my take on King, is that he was a very astute political leader. And that is the side of King I emphasize in my writing. I'm not denying the importance of King's religious beliefs. They were absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. They were central to his life. But I want to stress King's leadership in a political sense, and to bring out the point that the civil rights movement achieved its victories and successes not merely through marching and praying and not merely through moral persuasion, but through very clever tactics and extremely well thought out strategies.
Biographer and historian Adam Fairclough. He'll be back in just a moment to discuss his new books about Martin Luther King Jr. and about race and democracy in the United States. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part two in a series of discussions for Black History Month 1995. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Since he was killed in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. has become an American icon. His memory and legacy have also developed into something like a national screen onto which people project a variety of images about race and social equity. Historian Adam Fairclough is the author of a new biography of Martin Luther King Jr. Fairclough recognizes the power of King's personality and his importance as a charismatic religious figure. But he also emphasizes King's ability as an astute political leader and social catalyst. Adam Fairclough is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. His new book is entitled Martin Luther King Jr., A Brief Biography.
I think one way to understand how King thought was to realize that he was a kind of intellectual magpie. He took ideas from this thinker, that thinker. He didn't worry too much about whether these philosophies or ideas were consistent. He would take a bit from Hegel, he would take a bit from Marx, he would take a bit from Reinhold Niebuhr, mm-hmm. and he would shape some kind of strategy or mode of thinking from these various elements.
He was eclectic.
He was eclectic, uh-huh. and I think he followed the same approach with regard to his leadership. He was a man who could utilize the talents of many different people. He drew advice from white intellectuals and white leftists, as well as black church leaders. Mm-hmm. So he was a very thoughtful man who consulted widely and thought very deliberately. And he was able to really draw upon the experience of others. And this was the way he proceeded.
Was he, I don't know if we want to reach any bottom lines mm-hmm. here, Adam Fairclough, but I mean, was he, after all, the leading strategist of the civil rights movement in the South? Or some of his critics will say that Martin Luther King Jr. was really in bringing up the rear guard. Mm-hmm. He was good as an orator, mm-hmm. you point that out, but that he wasn't really the master thinker and strategist mm-hmm. at the forefront of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Where do you fall on that?
Yes, I think there's a danger that we fall into the trap of being too concerned with credit, giving credit to this organization or that person. I think there's room for giving all the participants in the civil rights movement the credit for the movement's achievements.
That's one of the things that King himself did, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. But I think King was nevertheless extremely important as a strategist. And for example, the thing that brought this home to me most clearly and vividly was to read the notes that King wrote while he was in jail in Selma. And he was there for a few days during this important campaign, which eventually resulted in the Voting Rights Act. And King wrote down in detailed point-by-point instructions how the campaign should proceed day by day. And King didn't often commit this kind of thinking to paper, but here we can see this master tactician actually mapping out the campaign.
What about, to explore another facet of King's personality, what about the argument that he was indeed the quintessential charismatic orator, that politics didn't matter to him? You say that he was in a league by himself when it came to public speaking. You certainly don't ignore that part of his personality. How about it? His, you know, again, charisma.
Oratory was absolutely central to his appeal. And Keith Miller, in a book published a couple of years ago, studied King's sermons and speeches and showed very cleverly how King used images and quotations that were familiar to most people. He sort of recycled them. And he made his thoughts accessible because people could pick up on these quotations and ideas, which were, you know, they already knew. But I wouldn't stress too strongly King's oratorical abilities. That there were many good orators in the civil rights movement. There were many good speakers, but there was only one King. It was his ability to combine this mass appeal with actual concrete leadership. He was a man of action. I would see King primarily as a man of action. He was the one who went to jail. He was the one who devised these strategies. He was the one who pulled together an organization. He was the one who could actually mobilize people in the Deep South.
What about the to put not a negative spin on the conversation, but we want to tell our listeners, Adam, that your book is very critical of King in some senses. This is not an act of hero worship that you have put down on paper here. You talk about King as a synthesizer, somebody who can pull ideas together. There was the charge that he was, to put it harshly, a plagiarist. Now here we cross into that area of the difference between what this person does and what this person is, his personal life, all of that sort of thing. How important is an understanding of that to you as a biographer of King?
I think it's something you can't get away from. I suppose, you know, broadly speaking, the character issue. And that there are two issues here. One is the plagiarism charge. And I think this is important because there has been a tendency by some students of King to portray him as an original thinker. And I think when one sees how he wrote his student essays and his dissertation, one has to conclude that, no, he was not an original thinker. But at the same time, I think it's a bit of a tempest in a teapot. I don't think whether he copied passages from books and put them in his PhD dissertation, I really don't think that has much bearing on his leadership.
What about the more serious charge that he was a womanizer, that his personal life, in effect, betrays the public ethics that he stood for? What do you make of that?
Well, I suppose that's a more serious issue. And I think one has to remember that the moral climate today is very different from the moral climate of the 50s and 60s. I think you have to look at the kind of pressures King was under, the kind of life he lived, the incredible amount of time he spent away from home, and the strong attraction he had for young women.
Let's put Martin Luther King Jr. into the context of American politics in the 1950s and 60s. He had, in some senses, rewarding and in other senses, very troubling relationships with some of our major political figures. Is there one of these relationships that is particularly vivid to you as his biographer? I was thinking of Hoover or LBJ. You pick somebody and talk to me.
Well, I think his relationship with LBJ was absolutely fascinating. LBJ himself, of course, is a really compelling figure with a multifaceted personality, a sort of Jekyll and Hyde character. When Johnson became president, people in the civil rights movement were rather concerned that he had a white Southerner who now heads the country. And this might be a major obstacle. Of course, we all know that Lyndon Johnson turned out to be a magnificent champion of civil rights. And for a while, King and LBJ were almost political allies. King virtually campaigned for Johnson in his 1964 election. But then they fell out over Vietnam. And King struggled with his conscience, and many of his advisors said, don't fall out with LBJ, you can't afford to sacrifice that political influence, support him on Vietnam and he'll support you on civil rights. But eventually, King decided that he simply couldn't support the war, and even if it meant not getting any more invitations to the White House,
right.
He had to come out and denounce the war. And Johnson was absolutely livid and furious.
Now, one of the elements that this comment, Adam Fairclough, goes to is King's doctrine or notion of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And again, we're back to strategy here. You say in your book that he was absolutely committed to nonviolence. At the same time, there were people saying that black power, militancy, that's the way to answer our problems. Talk to me about King's doctrine of nonviolence in the circumstances of the American Civil Rights Movement. We look back and we say, well, it was inevitable. It worked. How did King come to it?
Well, I think part of the difficulty is that the word nonviolence doesn't really tell you much. It's sort of a negative word, nonviolence, the absence of violence. And I think...
It sounds very bland.
It sounds bland, and I think in the King Day celebrations that we observe every year, there's too much emphasis on nonviolence as simply peace.
Mm-hmm.
Nonviolence to King and to the Civil Rights Movement was active protest. Nonviolence was sitting in at lunch counters, it was marching in the street, it was actively defying the white authorities, actively defying the police, going to jail. It was a very assertive, active method of protest.
It was also a way to look at large victories and small mm-hmm. victories. You argue that Martin Luther King Jr. was willing, some of his critics said, mm-hmm. too willing mm-hmm. to concede the small victories with his eye on the larger mm-hmm. picture. What does nonviolence have to do with that?
I think that was a constant criticism of King, that... That, you know, it was even charged that he betrayed local movements
by not being militant.
By not being militant enough, I think King's position was that he had to mediate between this grassroots militancy in the South and national politics. There was a constant pressure on him to be more militant, but then the politicians in Washington and Kennedy and Johnson, they were constantly pressuring him to stop these marches.
Yeah,
He
learned some lessons, as I recall in your book, Adam. You mm-hmm. say he learned some very harsh lessons when he took his doctrines of nonviolence mm-hmm. and political protest out of the South and went to the North, for example, in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say? He saw some of the most vicious racism he had ever experienced there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of the problem was that in the American South, in the context of the Deep South, for African Americans, simply to have a peaceful march in the street was an act of defiance, and it really shook Southern society to its roots.
Right.
But to have a march in Chicago or New York, that's nothing. It doesn't have that same kind of effect.
Right.
This was the problem of translating this method of protest into something that was effective. And in the North, King really couldn't mobilize the numbers. And here he was in this enormous city, and the task of organizing the African-American population was simply beyond his resources. But also, the other element we have to remember, which is very important, is that in the South, Northern politicians support him.
Right.
When he went north and he's creating problems in their own backyard,
that was a different they
dropped him like a hot potato.
Right. What about his enemies, Adam Fairclough? Do you have a favorite among the enemies of Martin Luther King? He certainly took a lot of heat from a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about George Wallace, and then you talk about various politicians in the South as well as the North. Any particularly vivid example come to mind?
I suppose King's most vehement enemy must have been J. Edgar Hoover, or at least one of them, or the one who was in a position to do him most damage. And
was this a personal thing, or was this the Hoover and his communism?
It was partly Hoover's obsession with communism or anything remotely liberal. It was partly the fact that Hoover, I think, it's not unfair to describe him as a racist, and he viewed the civil rights movement as a threat, and he targeted King, in my belief, simply because King was the most effective black leader, and it's no coincidence that the FBI hatched a scheme to discredit King just a few days after the March on Washington, when one of Hoover's subordinates described King as a powerful demagogic leader. And he was referring to his I Have a Dream speech.
Adam Fairclough, we're talking about your biography of Martin Luther King Jr. How is the Reverend King's stock doing in the 1990s?
He has become an American icon. He is celebrated with a national holiday, with state holidays. His name adorns streets and public buildings and schools throughout not only the South but the nation.
Is this the way we should remember him?
I think King should be honored. But of course, the honor we accord King is a way of recognizing the achievement of the civil rights movement. I mean, King always recognized that part of his role was symbolic, that people need a figure with whom they can identify, a symbol around whom they can rally. So the recognition of King is also a recognition of how far African Americans have come. So it's important. On the other hand, yearning for King and this nostalgia for King and that era is perhaps a little dangerous in the sense that, you know, the civil rights movement was not simply one charismatic leader and a mass of followers.
Well, you say that a lot of young African-American kids today, particularly African-American mm-hmm. kids in the 1990s, have essentially lost touch with this man. I mean, they're mm-hmm. aware of him, as you said, as an icon, but mm-hmm. they don't really have any powerful connection to him. Is that good or bad?
I think it's unfortunate, but I think it's simply a reflection of the profound economic malaise that is afflicting a large part of the African-American population. Where in the inner cities, the economic position has declined, is worse than it was 30 years ago, that there is more segregation than there was 30 years ago. Now, these are the issues King was trying to address towards the end of his life. So I think when young African-Americans hear I Have a Dream trotted out year in, year out, it becomes rather tedious, and they can't connect to it.
Would you say that King's critique of American mercantile capitalism or whatever form of capitalism mm-hmm. that we're practicing these days, is that still as important now as it was when he made his observations about our way of life?
Well, I think that the economic changes that King was concerned about have simply become more pronounced and have had more damaging effects.
Does that make him a prophet?
I don't think he was a prophet. He simply picked up on ideas that were fairly common at the time. But what he was trying to do was to make poverty the central concern in American politics.
Yeah,
Civil rights had been achieved.
Yeah, the poor people. That mm-hmm. was a phrase that was very important to him.
Absolutely. And, of course, as Black Power was emphasizing Black solidarity and Black separatism, King was trying to go in a rather different direction by uniting poor people, whatever their race, whatever their ethnic background, and saying that, you know, you cannot advance the economic interests of African Americans without advancing the interests of all poor people.
Adam Fairclough, let's shift gears just momentarily. We've been talking about your book on Martin Luther King Jr. Summarize for me briefly this new book that you've written called Race and Democracy. Here you're looking mm-hmm. at the civil rights movement in Louisiana. Why Louisiana, for example?
Well, I think Louisiana is the most interesting southern state. In some ways, it's rather peculiar and even rather exotic. But it makes an interesting study. Louisiana is the only southern state where you have a lot of Catholics. It has New Orleans, which is, you know, an old city which has a history all its own.
That's a different planet down there.
Yeah, yeah. one could argue that. It has a large immigrant population. It was the only southern state which really attracted a lot of Germans, a lot of Italians.
So what we're talking about here is what political enfranchisement, not civil rights in the mm-hmm. typical phraseology when we think of African Americans alone.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right?
I think that Louisiana had its own political culture. One of the things I was trying to do was to see how the movement evolved within a particular state and to see whether the politics of a state or the historical background of a state affected
race relations.
It wasn't a particularly violent example of civil rights as we look back on the 50s and 60s. You didn't have as much, am I right about this? There wasn't as much turmoil in Louisiana as there was in some other locations in the South.
No, well, there was a fair amount of turmoil and there was a fair amount of violence. The Klan was there, people were murdered, but it's true that it was not... There wasn't as much violence as Alabama and Mississippi. Uh-huh. Now, I think part of the reason for that is that there were moderating influences at work in Louisiana. One moderating influence was the Catholic Church. Another moderating influence was the tradition of sort of class politics, which had been pioneered by Huey Long in the 1920s and 1930s.
We can't avoid.
That's right. But then by his brother, Earl Long, who was governor in the 40s and 50s. And the Longs basically... They were not racial integrationists by any stretch of the imagination, but they really appealed to poor people rather than exploiting the race issue. You also had some very influential federal judges who were racial liberals, people like John Minor Wisdom, who went to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, Skelly Wright, who integrated the New Orleans school system. The importance of having a good crop of federal judges... That was absolutely crucial.
One of the elements in this book, as I understand it, Adam Fairclough, is a point of emphasis on education and on the life of teachers in Louisiana. Why are they important to you as you write about race and democracy?
In the black community, there were two groups of people who were especially influential. One, as everyone knows, were preachers, ministers. The other was teachers. Now, in a society where there weren't that many economic opportunities for African Americans, the teaching profession was very important. Teachers were middle class. They were respected members of the community. But of course, they were on the firing line. They were very exposed. They could be fired very easily. So for teachers to become involved in civil rights activities, that was an act of courage.
You're talking about the unsung hero, aren't you, and heroine. You're talking about the people who don't grab the headlines and yet who advance, whether we call it a movement or a unified cause, who make the statement in ways that are not necessarily apparent and vivid and journalistic, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. One of the things I found looking at the civil rights movement at the grassroots level is that for many people, the movement was not a period that began in 1956 and ended in 1965.
It goes way back.
It went way, way back. Many people joined the NAACP in the 1930s or 1940s, and they were in that organization for decades. It was a lifetime commitment.
Was there a lot of resentment? Did you find a lot of resentment? People who were, again, the unsung heroes and heroines who were looking at the Martin Luther Kings or the Roy Wilkinsons and saying, wait a minute, you know, the credit isn't being equitably distributed here.
There's a certain amount of resentment in that ordinary people's stories are simply not being told, or the danger is they're not being told.
Is that your responsibility as a historian?
Absolutely, I think so. And I think more people should be out there with tape recorders locating these veterans, some of whom are now in their 80s, and recording their stories before it's too late.
Adam Fairclough, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. We've been talking about your new book, Race and Democracy, about the civil rights movement in Louisiana, and we talked about your book on Martin Luther King Jr. How would you characterize the struggle, the movement of civil rights in the United States here in the mid-1990s? Is it utterly different compared to all of these historical situations that you've been describing?
It's much more fragmented and diffuse, partly because in the 1950s and 1960s, or and certainly earlier, the enemies were clearly identifiable. The targets were easy to define.
Now we talk about glass ceilings and things like that.
Now discrimination is something which is often invisible. And where discrimination ends and economic problems begin is often impossible to say. And also the great difference now, of course, is that in the South, you have black elected officials. You have black mayors, county commissioners.
More per capita than anywhere in the country.
Absolutely. More in the South than the rest of the nation combined. Uh-huh. Now, when politicians can't deliver, there is a sense of frustration. But how do you channel that frustration? The old line civil rights organizations like the NACP are going through grave problems. And it's very difficult to see the kind of unified movement, or relatively unified movement, that arose in the 1950s and 60s occurring again.
Do you believe, Adam Fairclough, a footnote to our conversation, that history teaches us lessons, that we can look back there, read books such as the ones that you have written, and actually be better prepared as we try to make the judgments and in our policies and behavior when we look to the future of American race relations?
I think that one can learn lessons, but of course, you know, here your politics comes in. One of the lessons one can learn is that under certain circumstances, nonviolent protest can be effective. I think one can also learn that a resort to violence in a democratic society is dangerous and ultimately self-defeating.
Adam Fairclough is the author of two new books, Martin Luther King Jr., A Brief Biography, and Race and Democracy. Both are available from the University of Georgia Press. Before spending the current academic year at the National Humanities Center, Adam Fairclough taught at St. David's University College. Next fall, he begins teaching at the University of Leeds. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio tape of this discussion. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was historian and biographer Adam Fairclough. Cassette tapes of this program are available postpaid for $10. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 750. That's program number 750, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again, 27709. Send us your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week, part three of Soundings for Black History Month 1995. Michael Eric Dyson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill will be here to talk about two of his books, Reflecting Black, a collection of critical pieces about African-American culture, and Making Malcolm, a study of the life and legacy of Malcolm X. Until next week, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.